We're back with side three of our interview with W.A. Wilson, our CAF Bomber Command. We left off on the last tape with Mr. Wilson driving to Steinhunde Lake Air Base in Germany, and we'll take it from there, I guess. And you were with, I believe, three other fellows.
That's right.
On your way to Steinhunde.
I don't think I mentioned about the reception we got there.
No, go ahead.
No. Yes, when we arrived at Steinhunde Lake, I found there were two friends of mine. One friend I knew very well, Flight Lieutenant Harry Trigg, who was the security officer for the aerodrome. And I proceeded to borrow £5 sterling from him because we had actually no funds. Our funds hadn't been taken by the Germans when we were captured. So, I met the Flight Sergeant Cook of the officer's mess, who was named Stradiotti, was from Vancouver, and was a former wrestler. And I happened to know his younger brother, who went to university the same time as I did. And so we got along fine together. And then the whole group seemed to enter into the spirit of the idea. And the motor transport branch, they sprayed our beautiful claret wine-colored Mercedes-Benz into an official-looking RAF car with camouflage, registration numbers on the hood, and a nice, beautiful RAF rondel in the front fender. On top of that, we got a phony kind of pass to give us permission to exit Germany to Belgium in order to return to POW control. So, and when we left that morning, the morning we left, Mr. Stradiotti gave us a large bag, paper bag, full of beautiful sandwiches. Another one had about 7 10-inch pies, and also we got some wine there, because I know we'd picked up wine goblets and a couple of German messes that we'd been in, and we were carrying them home as souvenirs. Also, of course,
I won't ask about the legality of that.
Well, it was war booty, you might say. I mean, they had taken everything we had when we arrived, and so we were just taken something in repayment. And we are also supplied with wine. I don't know how we got that. And so we started off in a beautiful morning as we drove westward towards the Rhine River crossing. And we stopped on the way for lunch, and here we were parked off the Autobahn and sitting on the grass bank, eating sandwiches and pie and washing it down with wine, good wine, and crystal goblets.
At this point, there's
quite a change in our diet.
Yeah, I guess after a couple of years of, shall we say, less than nutritious. Well, at this point, I guess the chances or the threat of recapture again by the Germans was diminished.
Well, the war was over at that point. Mm-hmm. It wasn't officially VE Day,
but as far as the Germans were concerned.
Yeah, they were out of it. But there were what they called werewolves around, which were German troops who hadn't been captured and who'd hidden out, and they had been active sniping at military vehicles on the Autobahns and places like that, or lone soldiers who'd wandered away too far away from security. But we weren't too concerned about that, and we drove on. And then, as it became dark that evening, we wondered where we were going to stay that would be safe. And so we ran across a GI outpost, and we spoke to the sergeant there and asked him if he knew of any accommodation we could get. So he climbed on the car and drove us. We drove into Munster and right up to the motor transport base that had taken over a German distillery. And there we were. We met the CO, a colonel in the American Army, and but first we went in, the sergeant came with us, asked us if we wanted something to drink, and we went to the canteen, and they had Coke and other things like that. They had wine, and they had hard liquor, all free on the house.
So I presume you did want something to drink.
Yes, we did. And then the colonel asked us up to his private quarters, and we went up there, and there was a British Army major and a British Army captain there as guests, and we four air crew. So we had a nice party there, and the British Army told us we'd never get the car across the Nijmegen bridgehead, that we'd be stopped and they would confiscate it. So the next morning, we go to bed, nice clean sheets, and wake up in the morning and give them some apple, grapefruit juice, and then we had a hot cake breakfast with eggs and bacon, and really top class cooking. And we got out of our car again, say goodbye to everybody, thanked them, and carried on towards the river crossing. And as we drove up the river crossing, we saw a military truck in front of us. So we got close behind it. The driver had to stop and show his papers to the guard at that end of the bridge. And the guard okayed him, waved him through. But we didn't stop. We just carried on behind the truck and waved at the guard. And he wasn't able to do anything. He didn't do anything. He thought we were all officers in an official car. And so that was that. And then we got to the Dutch border, and we thought they would be strict. But the American sergeant was in charge there, was questioning our documents, but the civilian customs agent for Holland just waved us through, gave us back the pass that we'd given to the guard, our papers, and we went on. And then at the Belgian border, they saw us coming, and they raised their obstruction up and waved us through without even stopping us. So we went from there to Liège, stayed there overnight, and because we had to pack it up for the night. And the next morning, on the way to Brussels, it was very dusty and sunny weather, but the roads were dusty, and we got hungry around noon hour, and we saw a cafe on the side of the road, a football palace. So we went in there, and the host and his wife were so friendly, and they gave us eggs, scrambled eggs, and toast, and lots of food for us. They knew we were hungry. They also supplied us with towels and soap to go and wash ourselves, because we were very dusty. And then we felt we had to repay them, so we went out the car and found some remnants of a Red Cross parcel, soluble coffee, margarine, and cheese and other things like that, and we knew we wouldn't be needing them anymore, so we brought them in and gave them to the cafe owners. They spoke to one another, and the husband went off and came back later and he had a bottle of cherry brandy. This bottle they had saved since the start of the occupation until the war was over, but they felt this was a good time to celebrate. So we sat back and we each had two or three glasses of cherry brandy, and finished the bottle, and then we left for there and headed to Brussels.
In a good mood.
Oh yes, very happy. And then we get to Brussels, we reported to the PWX Center, which was for returning POWs, and got documented there and reported our name, rank, and number, and service we were with, and then they had seen our car out in the lot, and they said, just leave that car in the carpool so that, you know, they figured that was the end of our transportation needs, because we'd be flying home to England from there. But we didn't. We had other ideas, and we drove the car around. We found an empty private garage and got permission from the owner to store the car there, and then we proceeded to try to sell it in the black market. We didn't do very well, actually, but we did get 40,000 Belgian francs for the car, because they thought it was a stolen military car. It wasn't a stolen military car. It was a commandeer car that had been camouflaged as a military car. And the military authorities had no documentation on the registration of the vehicle. But anyways, we got 40,000 francs. We divided that four ways, and we were set. And we actually spent about 2 weeks in Brussels. Not AWL, because we stayed in a PWX hostel, but we stayed up in the attic, about the third floor up in this high house that they used. So the sergeant, who was too lazy to walk up the stairs to roust everybody out in the morning to get on the transport back to England, let us sleep in. And so we'd get up and go to have breakfast, and kill the day sightseeing, and so on, and then end up at the NAFI Officers Club in the evening, where we had a very pleasant time, and I met a captain in the, I forget the regiment, he was from Prince George, Frank Perry. His dad was an MLA in Victoria, and he'd gone to UBC when I was there. And, I met him, I saw him there and I knew him, so I called him over and he joined us. But he'd had a little bit too much to drink, and when the orchestra there started playing a Western song, he staggered up and took over the mic, and he sang the lyrics to the song. And then he had to be helped off the platform. And that was the last I saw him there until we got back to Canada. And I also met Senator McGeer's son, what's his first name now? Michael McGeer. I met him in a cafe there one day having coffee, and I joined him because he was Canadian Air Force, and I found out who he was. And he was very disappointed because evidently his father was putting pressure on the authorities to get him brought back to Canada immediately, and so on. And I met different other people we had known, either. But one thing I was very proud of was the different military personnel on leave in Brussels. The Canadian Army soldiers were all tall, straight, very physically fit, suntanned, brown almost, but their uniforms were neat, pressed, and their shoes shiny, as compared to the British Army, who were just as good soldiers, but they were very slovenly about their dress. They never pressed their pants and so on, and they just walked around. And the American GIs, who walked around with their hands in their pockets, and because they had rubber-soled shoes on, weren't the least bit smart in their walking around like the Canadian Army. And I was very proud to be a Canadian then. I've been very proud to be a Canadian before that, but that really emphasized it for me.
Sure, of course, discipline being one of the things that the Army was known for.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, no, but they carried it on in leave, too. I never saw any misbehavior or anything. And the Belgian people had a great respect. The Brussels people had a great respect for the Canadians. They thought a lot of Canada.
Which is a feeling that continues on to this day.
Oh, yeah, I imagine so, because they were decent people. Anyways, so after 2 weeks there, we finally thought it was time to go back to England, and we flew back to an airport near Oxford, got documented there. But I wouldn't submit to the DDT blow on that came along with a DDT gun and sprayed it on your hair and then sprayed it down your back and sprayed it down through your chest And then you had to go and shower. I said, heck, we've been having showers twice a day for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and there's nothing wrong with us. And so the guy held his finger over the thing and went through the motions, and I didn't even have to have a shower there. But I think I did have one anyways. And we ended up down in Bournemouth and put in about 4 or 5 weeks there, on leave most of the time, and made one visit to Buckingham Palace, where they had a POW reception there. And apart from that, I went, visited all my relatives again, let them know I was home, and so on. And finally, about the end of the first week in July, we got on the Ile de France and came back to Canada. And but in retrospect, looking over the whole history of this service career, I always consider myself a civilian in the services during wartime when there was a need. And I always thought that a lot of these people who aren't officers are just the same as I am when we get our suits on again.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So I always tried to behave in that way, that just because you had a higher rank didn't mean you were more equal than they were. But and also I didn't let the discipline and the whatever, some of their historic precedents that they have in the services, I didn't let them interfere too much with my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I would evade going to church parade on Sunday mornings because I felt it was it wasn't even religious, and I would go and have breakfast instead and then go to a church of my choice.
Right.
And so on. But looking back at it all, I look at training, indoctrination and training into the services was very easy to take. And in fact, it was quite an easy life, I thought. You didn't get paid much, of course, but that was beside the point. Yeah, there are lots of other advantages you got. But then operations, 9 months I was on the squadron. There were a lot of scary trips and things like that. But they seemed to have gone back into the background, whereas my time spent as a prisoner of war and the people I met and the things we went through together, suffering and good times, always come more frequently to my mind than any other part of this, of the thing. I still remember people I knew in the various stages. I still remember them with pleasure, but I don't think of the bad times I had there or the good times I had there as often as I do the times I had in POW. And I think I learned a lot from my stay at POW. I learned the value of friendship and the necessity of food and shelter and good health, of course. Above all, money didn't mean anything. Status didn't mean anything. It was how to live and get by and under difficult conditions. And as because of that, I've never really tried to amass a great wealth or anything else, as long as I was able to make a comfortable living and be happy, and family be happy and be healthy. That was the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I still feel that I owe a great deal to the shaping of my life on my experiences in the services.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. That's a very commendable and a very admirable attitude. On behalf of the history faculty of the University of Victoria, I would like to thank you for taking time out to do the interview with us, and to wish you all the best in the future. Thank you very much.